This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. We've done a bunch of stories about how legalized marijuana will impact humans, but what about police dogs?
The dogs that are going to be brought into service, say, within the next year or so, will not be imprinted on cannabis.
GLT's Mary Cullen talks with Normal Police canine officer Shane Buchman about what will change and what won't. Plus, more from our interview with Congressman Rodney Davis, and a new episode of Make History introduces you to the first and only African-American physician in McLean County in the early 20th century. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The Bloomington City Council approved new labor contracts with over 50 parking enforcement officers, support staff, and inspectors who worked for the city last night. Here in studio to recap last night's council meeting and discuss other issues is Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Terry, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Of course, Ryan. Great to be here.
Well, I want to start with something that could be on the agenda later this month. A council member, Jeff Crable, says he wants the council to reject Connect Transit's budget in hopes of saving the Olive Route and avoiding these fare increases. He says this is the best way to trigger discussions about maybe raising city and town contributions for transit, which may reverse those decisions. What do you think of this move?
Well, I think the particular move is the wrong way to go about it. I think discussing this, we're going to continue to discuss it. In fact, actually, we have Isaac Thorne coming on Monday night, who's the director of the Connect Transit System, to talk a little bit about that. And I think there are lots of improvements that are necessary. And there's also changes, I think, to the representation on the boards that are necessary. And the one thing that we have to understand is that there are not just two positions that most people have been focusing on that come from Bloomington. There are five positions over the next year. So as we think about this in a perhaps short to mid-term range, there are lots of opportunities to change representation. There are lots of opportunities to change policy. There are a lot of opportunities to ensure that the voices of those who are not able-bodied are at the table. There are lots of possibilities, again, as we move forward. I think this is bad because, well, if a majority of council say they want to put this on, and that would mean it would come on June 24th. Their fiscal year ends June 30th. So what that would mean is absolute total pandemonium if the council were to reject the budget, because none of our attorneys at this point can agree on what that even means. Does that mean Connect Transit shuts down? That way everybody loses on July 1st. Any of the writers, there's one school of thought that says that. Another says, well, maybe it's just an ordinance violation. Another one says, well, you'd have time to work the budget. Well, you'd only have 6 days, 5 days, actually, after the 24th, before the end of the fiscal year to do that. This is the kind of stuff that you see done at the national level that's disastrous. You see it done in Springfield, not lately, but for many years. That was disastrous. We don't need that kind of policy making in Bloomington. We know we have tools, and we hope that we don't have to use all those tools. This is one of the tools in the toolbox that we hope we don't have to use. I would call it the clear nuclear option.
Yes, it seems like there would be other ways to accomplish this, right? Couldn't you talk to Connect Transit, you pick a dollar figure, you pass a budget amendment that kicks in an extra X amount of money, and you send transit more money? Isn't that an avenue to do this that's
absolutely less disruptive? Or even we could even say, cut your budget and don't raise your rates. You know, I mean, there could be any number of things that we say, or some combination thereof, or whatever the case might be. In terms of the Olive Route, that's another substantive change. I personally would not want to get into trying to tell a transit board how to run transit, because that is something that we appoint them to do. And actually, if you see one of the latest maps produced by Vazoo, who used to be director of our region, McLean County Regional Planning, and you see the riders and the lines that Connect Transit has, they very closely align. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't going to be some people who are substantially inconvenienced. That's not the point. The point is that from the perspective of the community, Connect Transit is doing a very good job. Now, can they listen better? Absolutely. Can the board be reconstructed to be more representative of riders? Absolutely. But these are the kinds of things that we can accomplish without trying to use a nuclear option that might blow up in our face and others. I mean, if nobody has a way to get from point A to point B as of July 1st, that's a real serious problem.
I spoke to Jeff Craber about this yesterday. He kind of explained his reasoning for this. But what is your sense of other council members? Are there others who kind of support this idea that you think could potentially put this in play for later?
Yes,
this
I think
month?
There are some that do. I think there are some that are opposed. I think the council's all over. I think the jury is out on how the council will respond. And once we see the information and the data, and then people understand what this really means, I have to hope that calmer heads will prevail, and not that we don't try to freeze the rate increase to prevent that. Not that we don't make all the many changes that we've talked about. Not that we don't reform the system, but that we don't use this nuclear option that at this point is unclear what the consequences would be. And at the very least, they'll be harmful to our reputation, our city, our community's reputation for possible businesses or others, or perhaps our bond rating. There are any number of things. We are not the only people who can Google a city's name and find out information.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, here with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Mayor, I want to pivot to something on today's agenda at the Bloomington Liquor Commission. It's what's called the off-premises delivery ordinance proposal. So what is that? What is being considered today?
Essentially, what's being considered is the situation, and I describe it as a situation because any particular proposal can take on a variety of forms, that people from, and I'll just mention a couple of prominent grocery stores, Schnucks and Hy-Vee, do provide door-to-door service. They will deliver your groceries and other things. And you can also order bottles of wine or beer, alcohol. So the question would be, how do we monitor this? Do we need to monitor this? This type of service, or even perhaps getting things by mail, right, it is not going away anytime soon. In fact, it's probably never going away. And so, do we do much of anything about it? My thought on it would be, I tend to be a kind of a minimalist in this situation. I don't really like to have really detailed, overburdensome regulations. So I would tend to lean on the side of, well, from time to time, let's do a sting operation, have somebody who's under 21 order from a particular place and see if they're carded when the alcohol is delivered. If they are, then we fine them. And we let people know that we're policing this. That's my initial reaction to this proposal, the situation. There are any number of proposals we could go down. I would like to pursue the least burdensome upon businesses.
And just to clarify, I mean, how much of this is happening already? Would it be completely against current liquor code for it to be going on right now? What is sort of current practice?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, it's happening. And if it's against our liquor code, you'd have to have somebody make a pretty good case for how it's against our liquor code. And, you know, from my perspective, if we haven't acted on it, it's not against our liquor code, because you can't blame somebody for trying to make a profit on something if they don't know that it's illegal. And especially if lawyers don't know that it's illegal. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, and other communities are wrestling with it. And they've operated in a variety of ways. Some have prohibited it. I definitely would not want to go down that path. Some have regulated it, you know, to a very high level. Others have what I would call as a more laissez-faire approach, and that is monitor it, test it, see if there are violations, and you punish the violations when they occur. But otherwise, let the market flow and let people buy whatever they want to buy from grocery stores and have it delivered to their home.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, tomorrow night at 6 p.m., the Bloomington Public Safety and Community Relations Board is going to be meeting at the City of Refuge on Jefferson Street. On the agenda is the search for the new Bloomington Police Chief. So what is that going to look like, that kind of public forum, and what are you hoping to get out of that?
Well, I think that what I'm hoping, and I believe the review board is hoping to get, is some broad public discussion and ideas of what they would like to see out of, in terms of core qualities and policies that are pursued by the new police chief. So I would say this is really, really important. If you've got some strong ideas and situations or even compelling stories, this is the time to come forward. This is as we're at the very early stages of even thinking about the type of police chief we might want to help lead our community and lead our law enforcement for the next decade, possibly, or more.
And current Chief Clay Wheeler is set to retire here on June 21st, I believe. Is there been an interim chief named at this point?
There has not been, no. And my guess is that, that's going to have to happen fairly soon. And Mr. Gleason is out of the office this week. So, although he texted me last night, and I told him, rest. The nasties will hit the fan when you return, so we'll worry about that then.
Well, Mayor Renner, I want to end with something that came up at last night's city council meeting related to Councilmember Jen Carrillo. She recently called for a boycott of a new downtown Bloomington business that was going to be opening up. Their original name was the Gypsy Room, and many consider gypsy to be a derogatory term. Business owners have since said they're going to be changing that name, but Neil Carrillo has caught some criticism over that. You sort of interjected last night as the media, including our reporter Brianna Groh, was interviewing Carrillo, and here's what you said.
Come on. You know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that nobody is harmed. Everybody's learned a lesson. We all understand. We all have got to move forward. And there's nobody, I mean, Alderwoman Carrillo certainly wants to make sure that we have strong economic development downtown and all other things. And she's only been in office a month. Give her some time to learn. We're all learning. So that's my comment on this, is come on. Let's just move forward. Let's deal with the real problems in our city.
At the end there, you're hearing the voice of Howard Packowitz from WJBC. But I don't want to...
not supposed to mention the call numbers.
We're all friends here. I don't want to relitigate the merits of the boycott we shouldn't name things the Gypsy Room. But it seemed like you were bothered or at least exasperated a little bit that the media was even asking about this. You say, come on. I guess, why is that?
No, not that the media was even asking about it, but that they kept... I was right next to her and I was finishing signing documents. I thought it was so over the top, and I apologized to Alderwoman Carrillo. I said, I didn't mean to think that you needed my help necessarily. I was just exasperated. It's like, I was, come on, you've asked the question. All right. She said that, she would not do this again, that she didn't understand, but she didn't realize the normal channels that you might follow under these circumstances. So I think that's an answer. I mean, I realize not just your network or your station, but others, that there are cool gotcha moments that are, and this is one of those. And I think it's also a learning moment for Alderwoman Carrillo, and that she's been a social activist, so she's used to organizing people for social action. It's going to probably take more than 30 days for her to make the transition to being an effective policymaker and moving the community forward, but that's why I'm suggesting, okay, somebody kills your grandmother, all right, you got a right to be upset, okay. But on something like this, okay, you say, this is a big mistake, you shouldn't have done it, move on. I mean, given the kinds of things that we have to deal with, I would hope that continuing to beat up on Alderwoman Carrillo is not one of them. I don't think it's productive.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In his recent and only public statement on his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, Robert Mueller said if his team had thought the investigation cleared President Trump of committing a crime, they would have said so. And they did not say so. The implication is that Congress is the place to have that decision made. But in this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Republican Congressman Roddy Davis rejects that idea.
That's not how we run legal proceedings in this country. Investigators investigate crimes, and if there is no crime to be charged, then those investigators have to have the presumption of innocence. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. But the Mueller report, Charlie.
So do you believe that any president is indictable while in office?
Any president is impeachable, indictable, what have you. I'm not a lawyer, but I can tell you what that Mueller report says. What that Mueller report says and doesn't get enough highlighted. And this is what is very frustrating to folks like me who approved $35 million to go to this investigation, who approved funding to ensure that the special counsel had access to hundreds upon hundreds of agents, hundreds upon hundreds of lawyers, hundreds upon hundreds of unlimited subpoena access and unlimited grand jury access. What that report said was that not a single American that they could find with all of those resources colluded with a foreign entity to affect the 2016 election.
Yeah, we're not talking about collusion, though. We're talking about obstruction.
There is no obstruction.
Even when the president tells Don McGahn to get rid of the special prosecutor, is that something that the House should take up since Robert Mueller and the Justice Department believe that a sitting president cannot be indicted, that the proper role is in the House? Is that something that the House should take up?
The American people, when you look at every poll that's out there, are sick of these endless investigations. The Democrats in the House are going to take up whatever avenue they believe will lead to one thing, and I believe that they will impeach President Trump. And I don't believe there's evidence to do that.
Another piece of the Mueller report that is often overlooked is his insistence that there was, in fact, a widespread and deep effort by the Russians to influence the election. What should we be doing to combat that as we roll toward 2020?
Well, doing what we're doing right now. We've invested historic amounts in election security. We need to work together in a bipartisan way on election security issues to make sure that people like here in McLean County, Kathy Michael, have the resources she needs to secure her electoral machines and election machines that our voters are going to use so that she can continue to run the most fair and safest and secure elections as we can. What's great about our country is we don't have a nationalized election system. I trust our county clerks, our local city election officials, to run the most fair, safest, and secure elections.
It's not just the security of the election process, though. It's the public campaign and disinformation that the Russians were promulgating. How should the nation address that?
We've got a problem here in this nation with dissemination of information that is false, but people, because they read it online or hear it in the news, think that it's immediately true. We've got to stand up and teach this generation, our generations, and previous generations that are older than you and me, that what you read may not be true. Russia and other countries, they thrive upon propaganda and disinformation. And social media and some of our tech giants allow this to happen, even though they know where those funds and where those messages are coming from. I think Republicans and Democrats are both going to try to get to the bottom of holding them accountable. But let's not forget the fact that we just had a 2018 election. We had historic turnout in the midterms. Not one instance of interference has been alleged by any foreign entity. And that shows me we're doing something right and working in a bipartisan way to get that done in Washington. So that's a good thing that we've got our DHS officials working with our local officials. I convened a meeting with all of our county clerks, and a good majority of them showed up to that meeting in Decatur a few weeks ago and told us what their needs were.
What does holding tech giants accountable look like? Does that mean breaking them up? Does that mean fining or sanctioning them? Does that mean regulating them more closely with regard to how they administer their members and allow public comment on these giant platforms? What?
I don't know what the end result looks like. And certainly hope that American companies would follow standards in place that if they know that a foreign entity, a government, is trying to use dollars to buy misinformation and messages that are not true, or that are clear propaganda and disinformation campaigns, that they would think twice about taking those dollars.
What's the government role in helping them or getting out of their way, or however you like to frame it? What's the government role in suggesting that the tech giants do regulate themselves on this?
Well, that's why I think you're going to see the tech giants continue to come in front of Congress, and they're going to have to answer questions that many members of Congress that I serve with in both the House and the Senate will have for them. They're going to need to tell us what the solutions are. I don't think anybody in the tech industry wants Congress telling them what they should and should not do on a daily basis, just like you here at an NPR station don't want us to tell you how to run your station, even though you get federal resources.
Congressman Rodney Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Congressman Davis mentioned GLT's grant to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in his conversation. It's about 9% of GLT's total budget. Representative Davis's district stretches from the Metro East area to Bloomington Normal. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. While Illinois residents await the legalization of recreational marijuana, police departments are thinking about a different bud, man's best friend. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner and canine officer Shane Buchman about what legalized pot means for police dogs.
Whether it's marijuana or any other type of drug, that particular scent is imprinted in the dog throughout their training. And so what happens is the dog, when we utilize it in the course of field work, the dog is indicating on the scent that marijuana, cocaine, whatever that particular scent is present. And so that is then been deemed by the courts to be probable cause for a search of the individual, the vehicle, or whatever location. And so that's typically from the 30,000 foot level how that is done. Shane may have some additional specifics on that. And that's typically how we have utilized that when we have some suspicion that there are narcotics presence and the dog is available. We'll utilize that to help develop probable cause to then further the search or the investigation.
What other drugs and substances are dogs trained to sniff out?
Our canines here with the Normal Police Department are all full service narcotics detection dogs, which means that they're trained to alert to the sense of crack, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, cannabis, any packaging material, anything like that that has any type of drug residue or drug odor on it, the dogs will alert to.
So with the Illinois legislature's passage and Governor J.B. Pritzker's promise to sign legalized cannabis into law effective January 1st of 2020, how will the role of police dogs change, if any?
So it's basically a slippery slope for us right now. However, the states that have decriminalized marijuana or cannabis, they still do use cannabis-trained or cannabis-imprinted dogs in the field, such as the chief alluded to, as far as gaining that probable cause to go ahead and search a vehicle or et cetera. So as of now, I don't believe personally that it's going to affect us at all as far as our dogs go here.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Chief Rick Bleichner and Shane Buchman with the Normal Police Department. So Shane, you were just talking about how there's not going to be that much change for the police department's use of police dogs. Would there be any new training or updated training for potentially dogs coming into the force?
Yes, I believe that the dogs that are going to come into the force, they probably will keep that odor of cannabis eliminated from their initial imprintation process, because it's much easier to add the odor later on than to try to extinct it from the dog. So my personal opinion is that the dogs that are going to be brought into service, say, within the next year or so, will not be imprinted on cannabis.
And I would just certainly add to that, I agree with Shane, and we talked about it before, because having not gone through the full almost 700 pages of the bill, a lot of the other states, there are locations where certain cannabis is still prohibited. So, you know, if you are under a certain age, or if you're in a public place, or you're in somewhere where it's prohibited, then you still, it's still illegal to have it. And so it would be perfectly lawful in those position, or situations, to utilize the dog. Also, as Shane had mentioned previously, our dogs are multi-purpose, and so they certainly, narcotics detection is part of it, but also, you know, they're utilized for demonstrations to show individuals and groups as far as what the capabilities of the canine team is, are, and then also they can be used for individual tracking, they can be used for article searches and stuff like building searches, so it's not just one single focus that they're utilized for.
And this might be one of those questions that we don't quite have an answer to yet. Under the law that was passed and is still awaiting signature, is the provision that you can have up to, I believe, 30 grams of marijuana. I'm assuming dogs can't sense when it's over 30 grams of marijuana, so they would just be smelling for the scent itself. So how would that come into play in the sense of if you are finding a subject who may have over 30 grams?
Yeah, well, I mean, that question is going to be pretty much in the weeds again, because, one, you know, if it is signed, again, it's impossible. You can't determine what the quantity is in those cases. So the fact is, you know, whether it's, you know, 1 gram, 31 grams, you know, that's something that I think will have to be kind of vetted out in court. It's also one of the things, too, through the officer's training. I mean, we talk a lot about the dog's training, but officers are trained in that same thing. So when they're having interactions with individuals, they're dealing with them on traffic stops or whatever, you know, you can't just take that training away from them. They still smell cannabis. I would think it certainly is reasonable to be able to investigate if there's individuals that then have under that legal amount, then that certainly is legal. If they happen to have over that, then that becomes a criminal matter. So I would think that would be a pretty fine line that you would not want to eliminate the ability for canines or officers to detect cannabis and be able to further an investigation to determine the quantities. I think that's going to be the only reasonable way to do it.
Now, Shane, earlier we were talking about how when it comes to training these canines, it's easier to introduce a scent later on than it is to untrain a dog, essentially. So can you answer this question for me? Can you really teach an old dog new tricks?
Like I said, it's much, much easier to eliminate, or excuse me, to add an odor later on rather than try to extinct one or take that away from the dog. Also, that I believe would open us up in court as well, too, as far as any type of court proceedings, anything like that goes, as to where we would have to testify if the dog had ever been trained on the odor of cannabis, and then did we do any type of extinction training with the dog to get that odor removed from his scent. So I believe that it's much, much easier to add that scent later on.
Now, today we mostly focused on the use of police canines and the use of smelling for marijuana. What other changes are we going to see with this legislation in place that we should have our mind on?
Currently, the town of Normal, our police department, is authorized for 2 canine teams. So right now, Officer Bachman and his canine partner, Thor, are one team, and we just retired a canine. So we're in the point now where we're looking at going to be replacing that canine team. And so it really, at this time here, we're kind of waiting to see how some of this flushes out as far as once the bill is signed, once we've gone through it, once we've kind of identified that also the state, when they kind of come up and solidify in response to the statute change, what the training is going to be, or what the authorization through the Training and Standards Board is, because that's really going to drive a lot of what we do. So in the future, then that will help us make better informed decisions about our next canine and what type of scents they're trained on and how we move forward with that.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner and Canine Officer Shane Buchman. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council presenting BN by the Numbers Thursday, June 27th at ISU's Alumni Center. It's an update on local economic progress in McLean County. Tickets are available by emailing Becky at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Prairie Fire Theater takes it all off in their latest production, the classic musical Gypsy. Loosely based in the memoirs of Gypsy Rose Lee, the musical focuses on the manic machinations of the mother of all stage mothers and her fight to get her daughters on the stage. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
It may be Gypsy's name in the title, but make no mistake, this show is all about Mama. Mama Rose, that is, the stage mother that's a bitter concoction of ego, ambition, and brassy nerve. Portraying Mama Rose in Prairie Fire Theater's production is Kristen Monson. The director is Sandra Zielinski, who says there is no doubt this musical is a great American classic. But when it comes to staging it, Gypsy is quite a mother.
It has 18 scenes in it, and every scene really has singing and dancing. And so it's hard to mount. It's a beautiful piece of music, and the story is fun. I mean, it's not all bright and shiny, but it has a good story.
So let's talk about Mama Rose. And she's something of a monster of a mom.
Yes, she is. Oh boy, does she control the roost. But it's all, you know, I think as she goes along, it's all for her kids. It's all for getting out of a hole that she's in. It's for her taste, if you will, in wanting to be in the theater. But at the end, there's a different kind of a story that she gives. And she learns that it's all for her. And that's a huge breakthrough. She's not going to change and say that, oh, now I'm the best mother one could have, and I'm going to change everything that I do, because that's not true. That doesn't happen. But there is an acknowledgement that this was for her rather than for her children, and that's huge.
Being honest, the roles for women in music theater, if you're over 50, they're pretty slim pickings. And so this is just one of those roles that probably when you're 20, you think, oh, someday I'm gonna play that role. And I've just always been in the wrong place in the wrong time or too young. And so when Prairie Fire chose this show, I thought, okay, I'm 50, I can do this. This may be my last chance to do this. And so it was just too much. I couldn't pass it up.
Well, tell me about your interpretation of Rose. And as you say, it's all about her. That makes her rather unsympathetic.
That's true. It's very difficult. People think of her as this, the stage mother. She's pushy. She wants everything for her daughter, so she'll do anything for them, say anything to get what she wants. But she does have a very, a funny side. She's got this humor that's how she gets what she wants, I had a mother like that who was, not a stage mother, but she used humor and comedy to make people laugh during situations that were maybe hard. And I think that's a lot what Mama Rose does. She uses those wiles, those comedian chops. But you can't play her when you're interpreting her. You can't play her as if she's a bad person, because she thinks she's doing everything right. She thinks she's doing this for the right reasons and that she's being noble and sacrificing. But I think she makes a revelation at the end that, you know what, maybe I did do this for me after all, and she's going to have to kind of go on. That's kind of a sappy ending for a life of, she. If you read her biography, she was a very strange woman, the actual Mama Rose. But I don't think that was very music comedy material to throw in there.
Tell me about why you cast Kristen.
Beautiful voice. I mean, really a beautiful voice. And she has the grit that this character must have. And also, she plays with tactics in getting people to do what she wants them to do, whether it's sweet and nice or whether it's through blackmail, whatever it is.
Good one, Kristen. All right.
But it is that, and you could look at her and say, my goodness, she, somebody should come in and intervene. But she's Mama, so everybody does what they're supposed to. And this is in the 30s, early 30s, late 20s. So there was a much different view of a woman in those days than there would be today. I mean, she might be brought up on charges today, right? But that's not what it was in the 20s and 30s. And that's not what it was when, you're looking at a depression, getting out of one, looking at hard times, and how do you make your money? And particularly then when the theater was turning, was going away from vaudeville, was getting into burlesque, but also, you know, the talkies. All of these things impinged upon the kind of work that she does. So she has to look for means to be able to feed her kids. And sometimes, you know, she feeds them and she doesn't eat. So she's really a woman with a great heart, but sometimes she goes too far and, you know, then things happen.
Well, there are several showstoppers. One of the most popular songs to come out of that show was Everything's Coming Up Roses. Mm-hmm. Is it coming up roses?
Well, Rose thinks it is. Mama thinks it is. This is the point in the show where her daughter, June, baby dainty June, has left her, which becomes June Havoc, the actress. She's left, and she's eloped, and she's left. So basically, Mama thinks, what are we going to do now that she's gone? And her new brilliant idea is, I'm going to take Louise now and make her a star and convince her that everything's going to be fine because now you're going to be the star, even though she's been the awkward sister that was always pushed in the back. So it's kind of frightening for her, but Mama thinks, oh yeah, this will work. This is going to work. And it's a horrible idea.
But it worked out all right.
Absolutely.
You'll be swell. You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate, starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks, clear the tracks. You got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow. Honey, everything's coming up roses.
Is it true that Mama Rose is sort of the King Lear of musical theater?
Oh, yes. That's exactly what it is. I mean, she rages, you know, through storm, which would be her life, you know, fights against everything that comes at her, even those who are nice, much like Cordelia. You know, she lets them go. And in the end, you know, there is sadness with that. But she does unravel, and you think that she's going mad, as King Lear does.
How does Gypsy play in an America where almost everybody seems to want to be famous?
Wow, very easily. I mean, you have to think, the show starts in the late 1920s, so we're talking about Depression era. So these were desperate people, and there was no money anywhere. And if you could get your act booked anywhere, you might have a chance at stardom, which is the whole premise of the show. If she can just get her booked at these certain places, her kids can be famous, they'll be set. I think you're absolutely right. We have this idea of like American Idol and the, you know, so you think you can dance, and if you could just make it there, people will see you and your career will take off. But that's not really the case, you know. You're kind of like your 3 minutes of fame and then you're gone. But I think people, they crave that fame. You want to be remembered. You know, that's why we have monuments that are thousands of years old. I mean, that people want to be remembered when they die. And I think that idea of thousands and millions of people seeing you on stage or on the screen is a way of solidifying that.
What are the greatest challenges in mounting this play?
Now, if you see the edifice behind us, one of the great challenges, not only musically and not only choreography, and then taking these small sequences in between and make them as much as the choreography, as much as the singing, as important as, that's difficult because our actors are spending a great deal of time singing and dancing. So you have to bring that up to speed. You have to balance all of those balls in the air. But the other great kind of issue is, how are you going to do this show when every scene is in a different place? You know, it's a stage. It goes to her home. It goes to a railroad station. It goes all over. So the edifice that is behind us, but it is like a huge arch that will turn during the show.
And each side gives you a different location.
Yes, yes. All of these things have to be shifted by the cast. There's no crew. So the cast not only sings, dances, does the scene work, but they move the set. And we just grab, pull, and do. So that's the challenge.
I wanted to brag on Sandy for a minute because this whole idea and concept for her transitions between the scenes, I think are going to be beautiful. I think nobody likes to go see a show where you wait 2 minutes for the set to change. That's just so aggravating. It doesn't happen anymore in theater. People don't want to see that. And this could easily have been one of those shows if it weren't for Sandy's direction. The set is turning, the actors are moving, the dialogue starts as the scene is still shifting. And I think that's what modern audiences, I think they appreciate that. And so I'm just going to brag on her.
I'm blushing.
That's director Sandra Zielinski and performer Kristen Monson. Gypsy runs this Thursday through Sunday at a new venue for Prairie Fire Theater, the auditorium of the Astroth Community Education Center at Heartland Community College in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Actress Kristen Monson talks about the place of burlesque in American theater and some bonus audio right now at our website, wglt.org. Now we turn to local history. Eugene Covington was the first and only African-American physician in McLean County in the early 20th century. GLT's Mary Cullen produced this episode of McHistory, showing the struggle of African-American residents when Jim Crow laws hit McLean County.
From the turn of the last century to his death in 1929 at the age of 56, Eugene Covington was the only African-American physician or doctor in McLean County. He was born in 1872 in Rappahannock County, Virginia, to parents who were formerly enslaved. Of course, that's 7 years after the end of the Civil War. His parents embraced education as kind of a way out of the life that they were living, so he graduated from Howard University in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., one of the nation's still today premier HBUs, or historically black universities. Eugene Covington then, with a medical degree, will arrive in Bloomington 35 years after the Civil War, around 1900.
I hold that where even the Negro has had a chance to use the ballot unmolested by the threats of blackmailing politicians, he has used it judiciously. My name is Gregory D. Hicks, and I'm a Discovery Walk actor.
This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History. The promise of post-war Reconstruction America, that is after the Civil War, the idea that the United States would seek to embrace political and civil equality and rights for freed people, formerly enslaved African Americans in the Deep South, by 1900 had been mostly abandoned and forgotten. So there is really a retrenchment in the United States in the area of civil rights from the period after the Civil War into the 1930s and beyond. And that is what Eugene Covington, an African-American physician in Bloomington, is struggling with at the time. And of course, the climate for African-Americans deteriorates. The civil rights climate worsens in the United States, not only in the former Confederate states, but we can't forget also in the North as well, and that includes Illinois. What Illinois State Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History Mark Wyman has called Jim Crow comes to Illinois. And Jim Crow comes to central Illinois in the first decades of the 20th century. So what we have heard or are hearing is Covington penning a lengthy guest column in the March 7th, 1903 Pantograph under the headline, The Race Question. And in it, he's criticizing an unnamed member of the local Board of Education, we don't know exactly who was demanding that African Americans, quote, do something to warrant and inspire respect. And of course, Covington is aghast at this.
Another distinguished gentleman who is a member of the Board of Education says, the Negro today receives all the recognition that he deserves. He has not shown the energy to advance to that position where he can command the world's respect, or rather the respect of the whites of the South. He must do something to warrant and inspire respect if he is to take a forward place.
We shall not be.
African Americans are not allowed to teach locally in Bloomington Normal or McLean County schools, believe it or not, until the 1960s. So yes, Illinois State Normal University is integrated relatively early on after its founding. Bloomington Public Schools and Normal Public Schools are integrated relatively early on. But yet African Americans who are educated at those places, at the public schools and at the Normal University, are unable to get a job locally to teach. So one of the forgotten stories locally, one of the tragedies of the Twin Cities, is the brain drain of educated African Americans for the latter half of the 19th and for much of the 20th century. They are unable to teach locally. So African Americans that are educated at what was then called Illinois State Normal University end up going to Chicago or Indianapolis or East St. Louis or Tulsa or elsewhere. And this community would be markedly different today if all of these folks would have stayed and raised families here. African Americans are also denied employment in most crafts, most high-end jobs, most professional positions. Covington obviously is one exception as a physician, but he's, of course, primarily treating African Americans.
It is also held by these states which directly or indirectly disenfranchise the Negro are guilty of deliberately violating the laws of the Constitution and have made the initiatory steps to secession.
Race relations are deteriorating in Bloomington Normal. In 1908, the Bloomington Park Commissioners establish racially segregated beaches at Miller Park. By this time, African Americans are being barred from staying at downtown hotels, prevented from eating at downtown restaurants. Yes, they could order a meal, but they had to grab it in a paper bag out the back kitchen door. Yes, they were allowed to shop at downtown department stores in Bloomington, but unlike white customers, they were not allowed to try on clothing. Eugene Covington and his wife Alice refused to attend theater in Bloomington. Why? Because there's segregated seating for African Americans. And again, this is in the North. This isn't in the Jim Crow Deep South. And this appalling situation will remain the status quo in Bloomington until the end of World War II.
It may be in his mind that the Negro has received all the recognition he deserves. But who other than himself knows what standard of recognition he has placed the Negro? Again, we would like the learned gentleman show us what line or course we can pursue that will not be antagonistic to our Southern brother in white, and in the meantime merit his true respect. We are told not to explain the right of suffrage. We are told not to aspire for military appointments. We are told not to apply for positions as teachers, and yet the gentleman says we must do something to merit the respect.
Eugene Covington, as a physician, will have a private practice, but he is also a member on the staff at St. Joseph Hospital and has full privileges at Mennonite Hospital. Mennonite Hospital will later merge with Broca Hospital, and today we know that as Advocate Broman. St. Joseph admission records show Covington treating mostly black patients. As a rule, though, a white physician had to be in attendance when Covington performed surgeries. So there were even provisions, even humiliations of this physician. He was not allowed a freedom that white physicians were given.
Yet honored citizens and countrymen, in the face of these facts, are said to be reverting back to barbarism. Yet the civilized, humane, enlightened race lynch and burn us at the stake and call us barbarous because we can't help ourselves. We ask for no special legislation, but equality before the law.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
in the late 19th and early 20th century, African Americans were closely aligned with the Republican Party. Of course, that's no longer the case today. But of course, why is that? Because the Republican Party is the party of Abraham Lincoln. It is the party of the Emancipation Proclamation. It is the party into the 20th century that is the party that is going to defend, if any party is, African American civil and political equality. But by the time Eugene Covington arrives in Bloomington, that is no longer the case. The party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, by the early 20th century, was increasingly disinterested in racial equality. For instance, Covington was on the local Republican Party Central Committee in McLean County in 1909, though he and two other African Americans were not allowed to sit on the regular ward committee, but were relegated to an at-large, that is, all-black committee. So they were segregated within the Republican Party political infrastructure in McLean County. So Eugene Covington, a remarkable African American early 20th century physician, but yet he struggled against the fact that Jim Crow was being established in Bloomington and suffered because of it.
This episode of McHistory was produced by GLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History and Discovery Walk actor Gregory Hicks. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Mary Cullen, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.